So you meet a woman online.
I love her. I just love her.
But it turns out, thousands of other people are in love with her too.
Janessa Brazil.
Janessa Brazil.
Janessa Brazil.
One woman's image is being used by criminals to target innocent people looking for love online.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
Love, Janessa. My wild quest to find her. The unwitting human face of a digital con. From CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast. The Canadian healthcare system, once our pride and joy, is struggling in ways it has never done before. People are without family doctors, waiting in overcrowded ERs, struggling to find mental health support. Dr. Jane Philpott believes there is a way out and that it may not be as difficult as we think. She is a former federal Liberal cabinet minister. She served as the Minister of Health from 2015 through 2017. She is now Dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences and Director of the School of Medicine at Queen's University. And her new book is called Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. Dr. Jane Philpott is with me in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a fantastic book.
Thank you so much.
It says that you are concerned, you write this, that you're concerned about the well-being of Canada. If my doctor said that they were concerned about the well-being of me, of my well-being, I might start to get my affairs in order. I think I would be concerned. How did we get to this point?
There are many factors that got us to the point we are at. And I should first start by saying that what we have in Canada now is not nothing, but it's not enough. We have an incredible legacy of having built a system where everyone in the country has health insurance for care by doctors and care in hospitals. And I believe that we were resting on our laurels in that regard and thinking that we had something amazing, that it was the best in the world. And over time, we have not done the maintenance necessary to be able to modernize our approach to healthcare. And we've, through the pandemic, cracked the system open. And it's now in a state of disrepair.
You say that the system is broken and that people are losing faith in it. What is most concerning to you? What's the most concerning part of that broken system?
The most concerning part of that broken system is that there are probably about 7 million people in the country who neither have a family doctor nor any other access to primary care. That's the front door to the health system, and there's no front door available for about a quarter of our population. And what are they left to do? They're on their own. No one is screening them for cancer. No one is maintaining their chronic illnesses. And no one is caring for their mental well-being. It's truly shameful that we've allowed it to get to this point.
You say that family doctors are kind of a species at risk. Why do you use that phrase?
Well, family medicine is an extraordinary specialty. I've been a family doctor for almost 40 years now. I love to call myself a family doctor. I think it's a huge privilege to be able to do that. But fewer and fewer of our medical school graduates are choosing family medicine. We've reached the point now that just a little under 30% of them want to be a family doctor. They see how hard it is. They see that the conditions of work are not great. And even among those who graduate from our family medicine programs, very few of them go into what we call comprehensive family practice, where they cover everything and you can go to see them with any need that you might have. They're going into very specialized or focused areas of practice. And that has really left us short of access to the care that Canadians need.
I mean, you're the director of a school of medicine. Do those students who are making their way through to become doctors, do they say to you why they would not want to go into family practice? This used to be something that people, it was the pillarstone of a community in some ways.
Well, I would say it's still the cornerstone of a community. The problem is that not every community has that cornerstone accessible anymore. I have conversations about this with medical students on a regular basis, and they acknowledge how hard it is. They acknowledge the importance of primary care, but they're also concerned about their own well-being and what they see when they look at the models that are in front of them, the family doctors that are burned out, that are leaving comprehensive practice, that are finding that they can't get a break. It's not particularly appealing to them. They recognize that we haven't actually got a system built in this country. And so they choose what is actually an easier path to go into a specialized area where we've built the supports around them. And we need to create the conditions of work so that people will find the profession and the specialty appealing again.
So you propose a model where everybody has a primary care home. What does that look like?
So when you use the term primary care home, sometimes people get a bit confused. They don't think of healthcare as a home. They think of long-term care homes, but that's not what we mean when we say a home. We use the term home in the sense that this is a place where you belong. This is a place where everybody knows your name. And we use the term primary care home because it's not just about family doctors. It's actually about an interdisciplinary team. There are many people that deliver primary care. They may be nurse practitioners or nurses. They may be social workers or dietitians. They are all part of a team. And we can not only create better access by sharing the work out across that whole team, but we can actually sometimes provide better care. You know, dietitians provide better nutritional advice than I ever did as a family doctor. And so this is a way that we can actually build a support in a community that can be the heart and soul of our healthcare system. And that should be in every community. I use the example in the book that it's just like every community has a public school where we can be guaranteed that our children have access to education. We should have the same thing for access to primary care.
Tell me more about that in the school parallel, because you say that if we had a system where, what, only 80% of the kids were in school, that they were only guaranteed education, that we would say that that's unacceptable.
Exactly.
You see a similar line that we could draw to access to primary care.
Well, I love this metaphor because people can grab hold of it easily. So, you know, I always think about when my family and I moved back from West Africa to Canada in the late 1990s, and I didn't think for a minute about whether my kids would be able to get access to a school. And it's still the case that you can move to any neighborhood, any city or town, rural part of this country, and you know your children will be able to go to publicly funded elementary and secondary schools. We actually have taken that incredible system for granted. But you move to another city and there is no guarantee you're going to be able to find a family doctor. In fact, people beg and they wait on lists and they drive, you know, hundreds of kilometers.
You're in Kingston. There was a lineup. How long was the lineup?
Oh, there was an extraordinary lineup of people waiting for care, and they've been waiting on wait lists for years. If we had let this happen in our public education system, people would be marching in the streets saying it's unconscionable. So why have we let this happen in our healthcare system?
Why have we let it happen in our healthcare system?
Well, I think, as I said, it's a case of neglect. It's a case of sort of thinking that we had something that we didn't really have. You know, I think people have not believed that it's possible to do this. There's always worries that we can't afford it, when in fact the reality is that countries that have strong systems of primary care actually pay less per capita for healthcare and they get better outcomes than we do.
When you talk about, and people may know the phrase family health teams. We've talked about this on our program. I'm lucky enough to be part of a family health team. You talk about this being open 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And we talk about cost. How much would it cost to create family health teams for people across this country so that they have access to that kind of care?
So we've done the calculations in Kingston because we've been advocating. We would like to be a city in Kingston where every single person has a primary care home. And we've calculated what it would cost to have the overheads that you need, plus the people, which are always the most expensive part for the doctors, the nurse practitioners, the OTs, PTs, et cetera, that it needs. And it actually works out to about $500 per person per year of public funds that it would cost to be able to provide that wraparound service in a neighborhood. You know, that adds up to a lot when you're talking about the entire country, but it's a whole lot less than we spend on things like hospitals. And we need to focus our attention on primary care. We spend actually about 6% of our healthcare dollars right now in primary care. That's actually a very small amount.
How do you think that doctors, family doctors now, would react to a big overhaul of the primary care system? Because as you've said, primary care is not just the family doctor. It's looking at a suite of services that can be provided by a range of people. How do you think the doctors would react to that?
So, of course, we've had these conversations. In fact, I spent most of my day yesterday talking to a bunch of family doctors about how we could do better. And there's always a little bit of angst. You know, family doctors and other doctors in this country have had a lot of autonomy, and the autonomy of physicians is something that we cherish. But I think people are so disturbed now about the lack of access to care that they are prepared to look at different models. And so, for example, we've asked graduating resident doctors whether they would consider going into a salaried system as opposed to a fee-for-service system. And in fact, more than half of our resident physicians now say they actually would like that. They would be willing to give up a bit of autonomy if it actually meant they had some structure, if it meant that they would get a holiday and be able to not have to be checking their labs and filling out forms on weekends and late into the evening every single day. So there's a bit more openness, I would say, now to doing something different. And this is one of the reasons why it's the time to fix things now.
A few days ago, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, was sitting in your seat. On this program, I asked him what he thought it would take to get the healthcare system in this country back to one that Canadians would take pride in. Have a listen to what Justin Trudeau said.
Well, first of all, getting a better understanding of what's working and what's not. We can't just throw money at the problem. I absolutely agree. That money needs to be spent in intelligent ways. And the best way to do that is to actually have accountability and transparency, not to the federal government by the provinces, but to citizens in the actual results pushing forward. And that's where the federal government is stepping in. We're not going to tell provinces how to deliver healthcare. The Constitution says they need to do that themselves. But we can make sure that they are measuring and demonstrating the improvements that Canadians deserve, including how many people are getting access to family doctors.
What do you think of what he has to say?
Well, I was happy to hear him say that it's about what Canadians want. I think that's a really important starting place. And we know that Canadians want to have access to primary care. You know, I think that he raised this issue about whose responsibility is it, and that's always a bit of a quick answer as to, you know, why this isn't happening. The federal government points to the provinces point to the federal government. My sense is that what Canadians want is for all orders of government to get together and find the solutions, agree upon what the standard should be, and to be able to, I would say, legislate that standard, to legislate a right to primary care, and to recognize that we can afford to do this and make a commitment to make it happen within a given period of time.
The legislation that you call for is the Canada Primary Care Act. How would that work?
So I came up with this idea partly, you know, on reflecting since I've left government. I've had a lot of time to think about how governments work and to see what are the levers that you have within government. The Canada Health Act is one of our most iconic pieces of legislation. It's almost, well, it's 40 years old on April the 9th, which is a big deal. It's not perfect. It's not perhaps as expansive as it should be, but it's actually a pretty simple piece of law that says, here are the principles. The federal government's going to give money to the provinces, and here's what we expect in return. I think we could use a similar tool for a Canada Primary Care Act that would say, here are the expectations. Every single person will have access to a publicly funded primary care professional team that will work together to serve the needs of every community. And if you lay out those standards in law, you agree that the federal government will make contributions to the provinces, and you'll find a mechanism by which there will be some accountability in the system. This is what we see in other countries that have done this well, and I point to some of those in the book, where there are places in the world that have more than 95%. A place like Norway has had more than 99% of their country that has access to primary care. And they have grounded that in federal legislation where people know their rights and they have a mechanism to say that their rights are not being met.
But you just heard the Prime Minister say that this is an issue of jurisdiction, the Constitution. He's not going to tell provinces and territories what to do when it comes to healthcare. That's the barrier that we often hear, is that healthcare funded federally is under provincial jurisdiction. In the book, you write, there is nothing stopping the federal government from implementing universal access to primary care right now. Are you serious?
I'm serious.
That there's nothing preventing the Prime Minister, who is sitting there, and his cabinet from saying, this is what we think Canadians need, we're going to do it.
The only thing that's stopping us from making this happen is the political will to make it happen. So it is possible. There is all the technology and the legislation. The argument around jurisdiction is one that Canadians need to challenge and say, actually, health is a shared jurisdiction.
And so when the premiers raise hell and say, how dare you tell us what to do with the money that you're... We've seen this already when it comes to the agreements that have been signed across the country with people don't want strings attached. What should be said to those premiers?
So it's not about what politicians want, it's about what Canadians want. And what Canadians want is that for their elected officials to get together, to come to consensus, to collaborate and cooperate and figure this out. That's what we have seen happen over the years. And, you know, in the beginnings of access to universal health insurance, it was about collaborating. It was about Saskatchewan coming up with a model where we would have insurance for hospitals and then insurance for doctors, and other provinces saying, what a great idea, let's actually make it happen. And the federal government coming together and saying, this is such a great idea, we're going to put it in our federal laws. And that is what we need to happen now in the world of primary care. I argue in the book that we should have we should ask for a first minister's meeting focused on making this happen. This is not about pitting one order of government against another. That is not how you solve problems in this country. You solve problems by sitting down together and saying, we're here to serve Canadians. That's our job. Here's a solution. It's an affordable solution. Who's going to chip in what resources to be able to make it happen, and how are we going to deliver for Canadians?
You were at that cabinet table. Did you ever propose something like this, a Primary Care Act?
I didn't propose it during the time that I was there. We had a lot of things on our plate when I was there, but I did see how things do work together when things work well.
And I just wonder whether it's easier to propose something like that when you're not
absolutely in the machine. Absolutely. And so, you know, what I'm proposing is a theoretical solution. I use a quote in the book where we talk about the fact that, you know, doctors are doing medicine, and politics is nothing but medicine writ large. It's a quote from the late Rudolf Virchow, and it says that, you know, doctors and people like me can propose theoretical solutions. It's the politicians that actually implement the practical solutions. I'm hoping that by sharing this and by having some sense of what works inside government, and I give lots of examples in the book about things that have worked and why it worked and why it works when people collaborate together, this will give hopefully some credence to my suggestion that it actually could work as a possibility. And more than anything else, my desire is that this will bring hope to Canadians to say, yes, there actually is a solution out there, because there's a sense of despair in health professions. There's a sense of despair in the public. And what we need is to be able to say, actually, here's something that could work. And would you please sit down together and make it happen?
That requires political will. This is a top issue for Canadians. I don't know that it's a top issue for politics. The Prime Minister was here. I don't know that he expected me to ask him about healthcare, for example. You'll hear a lot of money thrown around when it comes to housing. Those are big issues, housing and cost of living, what have you. Is fixing healthcare a winning issue for politicians, do you think?
Such an interesting question. And you know what? I believe that it is. It absolutely matters to Canadians. You know, I often look at polls that talk about what Canadians care about, and, you know, issues around affordability and housing are always very close to the top of the list. Healthcare is always in the top 3 to 5, and sometimes it's at the very top of the list as to what matters most to Canadians. So, like you, Matt, I'm actually shocked that politicians don't talk about it more. Perhaps they're afraid of it. Perhaps they think it's something that they can't fix in a short period of time. And, you know, another election cycle will roll around before they've been able to demonstrate progress. But we should be asking them, what are your solutions? And we should be asking provincial politicians that, and federal politicians, and we should not catch them without an answer.
Well, take a look at what happened in Nova Scotia and in Manitoba, where two elections, many people believe, flipped based around the issue of healthcare.
That made me really happy to see that in those two cases. And of course, people will be watching closely to see how well they can deliver on that. But I think that was a remarkable demonstration of the fact that, yes, you can run on a platform of healthcare. I'm really surprised when we're facing a federal election next year that we're not hearing any federal leaders saying that they have ideas. I hope a few of them will read my book, or their policy development teams will read the book and they'll say, oh, actually, here's something that we could do. We would like to be the government that, if you elect us, we will actually make sure that everyone in this country has access to a primary care home. So the plan is laid out for them, and I hope somebody will pick it up.
You say the stars are aligned to deliver the biggest disruption in healthcare since we introduced Medicare. You really believe that now is the time, and that, to your point, it may not be that difficult.
I believe the stars are aligned because the appetite is so huge, because it matters so much to people. And, you know, people have conversations in their homes about you know, things like affordability, whether, you know, the cost of groceries, which are becoming absurd and unattainable. But they also talk about healthcare. It's a dinner table conversation. You know, people, as soon as anybody finds out that I'm a family doctor, the first thing they say is, well, can you help me get a family doctor? And it used to be that, you know, there were a few people that would ask that now, but everyone asks me that. People that normally can use their power and influence can't even use power and influence to be able to access primary care. So this is something that really matters to Canadians. We should absolutely, you know, jump on this opportunity. There is a solution. It's an affordable one. It's what Canadians want. Wouldn't this be an amazing legacy to be able to leave for our future generations?
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a book about changing the healthcare system, as we were saying, but it's also a book about how you got to the place that you are in now and how you think about the healthcare system. And there's a lot of personal stuff that's in this book as well. You write about the stint that you had with your husband working in Niger and a journey in a car when your daughter Emily got sick. And this is a really hard story. People might know a little bit of the details of it, but there were things in the story as you told it that I had never heard before. Can you describe what happened in that car?
So, as you said, my husband and I and our family lived in Niger, the Republic of Niger, for 9 years. In the 1990s, it was essentially where we started our careers. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. I loved living there. I loved raising our young children there. But it also is the place where we experienced the worst day of our lives. At that point, we had 2 little girls. One was 2.5 and one was 8 months old. And we were studying the Hausa language. We were living about 2 hours away from the hospital where we had normally been based. And our daughter, Emily, the older one, developed a terrible rash that was a sign of something called meningococcemia. It's one of the most rapidly fatal infectious diseases on the planet. And I tell the story in the book of how she unfortunately died as we were trying to get her to the hospital. It was exceptionally difficult. It still brings tears to my eyes when I think about it, but it changed me in a way that no other single day of my life has ever changed me.
I mean, it sounds obvious, but how so? You were in the car, you're sitting in the back seat with her, she dies in your arms. How does that... I don't know, it seems obvious, as I say, but how does that shape who you are now and the work that you have done over the course of your life?
I would say the way that it changed me the most was not the actual day that she died, but it was what I came to understand in the days that followed. And I describe in the book that a couple of days after Emily died and we'd had the funeral, my husband and I walked out of the trailer that we were staying in one morning, and there was a lineup of people from the village that had come to greet us. And these were the people of Galmi village, people living in rural parts of Niger, some of whom we knew and had worked with and others who we'd never met before. And one by one, they came to greet us. And they spoke words of compassion. They encouraged us to be patient. And what I realized in that and in the further conversations I had with the people around us was that we were not special, that there was nothing exceptional about what had happened to us. And in fact, what we were getting was just a tiny taste of what the reality is for people that live in Niger. At that time in the country, 27% of children did not live to see their 5th birthday. And I knew so many women who had lost more than one child. And I knew the world was unfair before that, but it hit me like a storm. And I thought, wow, what kind of a world is this where 27% of babies don't get to have their 5th birthday? We've got to find a way to care for one another better. We've got to find a way that people that live in that incredible country of Niger have better access to healthcare, that they have better access to food and all of the other things that, that children need to thrive. And if I could do something in the rest of my life to try to make the world more fair, to try to give people better chances to be healthy, that that's what I wanted to commit every day to. And I've never forgotten that.
In that storm, one of the things that you held on to was faith. What did faith mean to you?
Faith has meant everything to me in terms of having hope. I talk in the book about the importance of having hope and how what it means about our wellness, and recognizing that there is actually more than just the material world around us. We've become such a secular society. We've become so focused on the things that we can touch and prove. But there's something about our souls that gets lost in all of that. There's something about recognizing that there are big spiritual forces around us, and that, you know, this time that we have on Earth is meant to be infused with a sense of the miraculous, a sense of the profound, and for me, faith and a belief that there is more to life than what I can see and touch and prove is part of what gives me the hope to go on.
You've never really spoken about that before, right? About your Christian faith before. Why is that? Why? I mean, politics is politics, and we'll talk maybe a bit more about that later, but why haven't you spoken about that before?
It's a great question, Matt. I think I was afraid to.
Afraid of what?
Afraid that people would think that I was trying to manipulate them. You know, people attach faith to religion and they attach religion to some sort of, you know, desire to try to convince other people to become part of your religion. And I think Christians probably have that in or are accused of that more than others, that they're proselytizing somehow if they talk about their faith. And so for me, especially as a politician, I didn't want anyone to think that I would ever use my faith as a way to change what I did, that I would serve people only if they were part of my same faith. And of course, that's not what either doctors should do or politicians should do. And so it seemed safer to just make it a personal thing and keep it quiet. And yet it's so much a part of who I am that as I wrote this book and as I thought about what drives me and what motivates me, I needed to tell people who I am so that they could understand why Health for All matters so much to me.
You say that you believe in the power of prayer with your whole heart and mind. What does that mean?
I do. I believe that there is a higher power. Lots of people do. People call that higher power by all kinds of different names. And I believe that there is someone, maybe you could call that someone a creator who put this whole world together, this whole, the galaxies. And that I have the ability to be able to communicate with that higher power, the creator, and to be able to tell someone what's on my heart, what matters to me, how I would like to see the world unfold. And sometimes those prayers are answered and sometimes they're not. But I have seen the miracles of prayer. I described the miracle of our daughter Bethany surviving meningococcemia. And I say in the book that she survived in part because of the miracles of antibiotics. But I also believe that one of the reasons she survived is because thousands of people were praying for her life.
Is that hard to explain to people who don't believe?
It's really hard to explain.
As a doctor?
It is hard as a doctor. Yeah. And I think, as I say, we've sort of pitted the sense of you either are a scientist or you're a person of faith, yeah, as if they can't both be held together. And we've done ourselves a disservice by separating those things. And so I start to step into some of that conversation in the book to say that, can't we actually talk about the deepest values of our lives, what we believe and what we don't believe, what we question, what our doubts are, all of those important conversations about being human have somehow been separated from talking about stuff like health and healthcare. And in fact, our wellness does depend on things like hope and belonging and meaning and purpose. And I talk about those in the book because, you know, we can have the best healthcare system in the world, but if people aren't well on the inside in their souls, or if our society's soul is crushed, then actually we aren't living fully and we're not living well.
How do you see that play out at a time now when we it feels like we are, I mean, there was a report that came out about incivility, people not talking to each other, not listening to each other, when it feels like people are polarized and pitted against each other. How do you see what you're talking about fitting into that time?
My sense is that we have our muscles, perhaps you could say, to be able to have hard conversations about heartfelt issues, those muscles have atrophied because we haven't been exercising them over the last several decades. In our wonderfully pluralistic, multicultural society, we felt safe to be secular, and we haven't figured out how we can talk about things like faith, where you and I might have different ideas about what that is, and we might even disagree on some things, but that I can respect you for having a different idea. I can, in fact, learn from you. And because we haven't been exercising those muscles well enough, it has left us in this world of incivility where we treat each other terribly and we say awful things about each other. And that does not make for a healthy country.
What happens when politicians do that? What's the role of our leaders, do you think, in creating that environment or creating those conditions for people to say, as you said, awful things about each other?
I think
that's a big sigh.
It's a big sigh because, oh my gosh, we have to learn to care about each other. And politicians have to care about each other, and they have to treat each other as human beings, and they have to treat the people around them as human beings. They have to, you know, when I hear, you know, politicians speaking with complete disdain for one another, when they respond to journalists and other human beings with such disrespect, I think, wow, that's not the kind of leaders we need in this country.
You're kind of asked to do that, though, right?
Like, you are. You know, yes, but, that's what's awful.
So there's a story in the book about you, I mean, the House of Commons, and what the House of Commons has become in question period. When you are directed in some ways to respond, well, you describe it.
So I talk about this in the book, and you know, this was one of the most shocking things about going into politics, was the fact that you are, you know, for the first time in my life, I found myself in a place where other people wanted me to fail. That was a shocking realization. But then even worse than that was that part of my job was to try to make other people fail. And I thought, what an absurd arrangement we have, that we elect 338 people to go to Ottawa to represent their community, to make this a great, strong country, and then they tear each other apart. You know, people, I'm sure, will call me naive for some of the things that I said in that part of the book, but I fundamentally believe that we can find a way to disagree with one another without actually trying to make other people fail. And so the incident you're referring to was where, you know, a couple of my wonderful young staff people came to me and said, you know, the Prime Minister's office says that you need to be more political in your answers. You need to be nastier. You need to use these lines like, you know, for 10 years under the previous government, blah, blah, blah. And I said, that's not who I am, and I won't be somebody different than who I am, and I won't tear people down because that's not going to help anyone. I'm here to build this country up, to build other people up. I actually want the people that represent a riding that happen to be in a different political party, I want them to do well because I want their community to do well, because I want the whole country to do well. And we've got to figure out a way to bring politics back to that place of respect.
You say that politicians should be more like doctors and admit their mistakes and apologize.
I do. Yes. So I had a lot of fun with that. I have a whole chapter. It's actually one of the longer chapters in the book that talks about the things that I learned as a doctor that helped me in politics. And I had fun kind of thinking about some of those clinical skills and how they might transform politics.
You asked the Prime Minister to admit that he'd made a mistake.
I did, yes.
And this was with regard to the Jody Wilson-Raybould story.
Yes. So I talk about the fact that one of the things I think doctors are trained to do well, and, you know, airline pilots are given the same kind of training, is that you can't deny mistakes. You actually have to admit when you've made a mistake. And in fact, one of the ways that we get better is by recognizing our mistakes, taking ownership for them, looking at who might have been hurt, apologizing to those who might have been hurt, analyzing how that mistake possibly happened and what you can do to prevent it happening again. It's a tremendous formula, and we actually practice it in medical school. We practice people disclosing to a patient that a harm has happened to them. And yes, I did have this conversation on a couple of occasions with the Prime Minister when I felt that he had made a mistake, and I had hoped that, you know, perhaps that same formula could be used. But we can't. It's not something that's part of politics now, except in rare circumstances.
So would you ever go back into politics? You say in the book, there's a line, it leaps right out. I don't know if I'll ever end up in politics again. That's a pretty big door to leave open.
So I would say I think about it as a door. The book makes it really clear that what I care about right now and what I want to spend every single day of my working life doing is trying to help make sure that this country is as healthy as possible, that we can build a world with health for all, that we can build a country with universal access to primary care. Right now, I get to do that at Queen's University, and I love my job. If a door ever opened that it seemed possible that politics could be part of my life again, I'd have a look at it. But right now, that door doesn't seem to be open, so I'm going to keep doing what I'm enjoying at Queen's University.
And you're optimistic about that work. Again, that seems to run through this book, that when we hear about 6.5-7 million people without a family doctor, seems like one of those too big to solve problems. It's not, do you?
It's not, because I've seen other countries do it. It's not that I'm just imagining this. There is hard evidence that it works, that there are several other countries in the world that do better than we do. And let's do it together. I really want the book to give people that hope, that belief that there is a solution. And as people come together and we build that national vision, that it will build the political will to deliver.
I'm really glad to talk to you about this. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jane Philpott is a former federal health minister, now dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences and director of the School of Medicine at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Her new book is called Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. It's out today.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.